The Dream Team tapes Season 2, Kobe, LeBron, and the Redeem Team, is a production of Divergent Podcasts in association with iHeartRadio.
Diversion Podcasts.
The players selected for the honor of representing the United States in the 2008 Beijing Olympic Games are Kobe Bryant.
We look forward to this for a while, you know, to be in this position now to be able to, you know, represent our country, man. It's special, special.
LeBron James.
We look for the opportunity to rekindle that flame of being the best in the world. I guess the Redeem Team is right.
We the best team in the world. We the best team in the world. We put basketball, American basketball, where it's supposed to be, which is at the top.
I'm Jack McCallum, and welcome to Episode 3 of the Dream Team Tape Season 2, Kobe, LeBron, and the Redeem Team. This is a sequel to my podcast last year called The Dream Team Tapes, but it's about another kind of dream team, the one that followed the Michael Magic Larry Immortals by 16 years, the one that earned a gold medal in Beijing after our international basketball fortunes had fallen so drastically in the early part of the century. Now, in our last episode, co-host J.A. Adande talked about Kobe Bryant, a lone wolf who became part of the pack that won gold. This episode is about the Redeem Team's other alpha dog. That, by the way, is the term used by Jason Kidd, who became the veteran leader of the Redeem Team. It's about that other alpha dog's eventful high school career, his eventful drafting into the NBA, and his eventful and disappointing adventure with the 2004 Olympic team. We're calling it The Future King and the Greek Tragedy. Now, we've alluded several times to Kobe being a kind of lone wolf. The song Solitary Man would fit him. The song I'm choosing for LeBron is going back in time a little bit to the Shangri-Las, a great girl group from the early 60s, which was before J.A. was born. But I remember him, of course. I wonder, J.A., do you have any idea about who the Shangri-Las are?
I'm not really up on the Shangri-Las. I love 60s music, right? Especially Motown, Aretha Franklin, Marvin Gaye, Beatles, Rolling Stones, all that. But I'm not too up on the Shangri-Las, though.
Well, there's no reason you should be. I'm not really. But they had this one memorable song called The Leader of the Pack. And, you know, had the motorcycle booming in the beginning. And I assume that's the one you know. You know The Leader of the Pack.
Yeah, I do know that song. I just didn't know who sang it.
Well, that's probably the only thing the Shangri-Las ever did. But I think of that, and it brings me around to LeBron and how he differs from Kobe. LeBron was a leader of the pack. He always had his guys around him. He was an inclusive guy. There's a lot of charming clips of LeBron from his high school days, going up to the podium after he scored 35 points and got 28 rebounds. And always he drags along the other four starters to the podium with him for a press conference. He looks like their father in some ways. But I found it very endearing and a real contrast with Kobe, who was not at all like that.
Exactly. And of course, a big part of the LeBron story goes on to become how he empowered his childhood friends, right? Guys like Maverick Carter, Rich Paul, Randy Mims, they all became big players in the NBA world now. Maverick Carter became a big marketing guy. Rich Paul's an agent, very powerful agent. And LeBron always craved the group and the inclusiveness. And that was very different from Kobe. Kobe was off on his own, as we talked about in the last episode. And at times, that was viewed as a detriment for LeBron, that he was too deferential, for example. I think especially earlier in his career, during the 2007 playoffs, when it was a critical moment in a playoff game, and instead of taking a shot, LeBron passes to Donyell Marshall, and Marshall takes and misses the three-pointer. And I was thinking, if that had come along a couple years later in the heart of the social media era, Donyell Marshall would have been trending all because of LeBron, as in people saying, how could LeBron pass to Donyell Marshall there? But LeBron always wanted to make the right basketball play, right? Even if that meant a pass. And he also wanted to make sure that everyone was a part of his family, his extended family, including his friends, that they were all included.
Going back to LeBron's early days, before the America really truly knew him, the Hoopheads did, Let's take a listen to this story about LeBron's early career.
So it was early 2002 when I pitched doing a Sports Illustrated feature story on LeBron. And LeBron was in his junior year in Akron in high school and had really made a name for himself the previous summer at the ABCD camp in New Jersey. And that's when he basically became the number one player in his class, but also in the class that was a year older too. He was the best high school prospect anyone had seen essentially in a very long time. And so the timing seemed right to do a story on him.
Now, that was the voice of Grant Wall, who was a writer colleague of mine at Sports Illustrated. Grant was a soccer specialist who nevertheless had been intrigued by tales of this superstar kid. Now, I was kind of like, I was the old-fashioned pain in the ass back then. I didn't think we should put young kids on the cover. I was busy covering the NBA. And though I had heard about LeBron, I didn't scour the internet like a lot of people. And I'm going, what are we? We have a lot of good NBA stories. Why are we doing this high school kid? Plus, over the years, Sports Illustrated had wrecked the careers of so many phenoms. We had a whole series of kids from high school we put on the cover. They were the next somebody, and we publicized them till they became the next nobody. Never mind college kids, Felipe Lopez, Sebastian Telfair, Johnny Manziel, Todd Marinovich, Ryan Leaf. There were a whole bunch of these players. I'm guessing, though, Jay, you looked at it differently. You probably said, I want to read more about this kid from Akron.
Exactly, Jack. And you know what? I'm thinking part of that could be the influence of the ESPN magazine that came out in the mid-90s, and their whole thing was next, right? On the cover of their first issue was Kobe Bryant, among others. Eric Lindros was another one. I think Cordell Stewart, that one didn't quite work out as well as the other ones. I think A-Rod, Alex Rodriguez, was another one. But ESPN magazine came along, and they were emphasizing next, the next thing. And I'm wondering, Jack, if Sports Illustrated got caught up in that a little bit and said, okay, we'll show you next. This is going to be the next superstar, the chosen one. We're going to put a high school player on the cover of Sports Illustrated at a time when the cover of Sports Illustrated was probably the most premium real estate in the sports world.
Yeah, but even as Grant Wall's about to tell us, even he was worried about that phenom factor.
I mean, I covered Freddie Adu as well, so on the soccer side. And so I was part of that tradition of screwing up phenoms.
If you couldn't quite get that, Grant was talking about Freddie Adu, who Sports Illustrated had managed to put on the cover when he was 14, proclaiming him the next Pele. He was not the next Pele. I'm not sure who he was the next one of. But I did check, by the way, Jay, and Freddie has 330,000 Twitter followers, though I'm not sure what they're following. But anyway, Jay, what do you remember about hearing about this kid from Akron, about the young LeBron, about the next? I don't know who we said he was. He was so physically manifest and developed that he wasn't painted as the next Magic or the next Jordan. He was really in his own class.
But I think those Jordan comparisons came, though, because if you were going to talk about someone destined to be the greatest, well, Jordan was still hanging over the league, even though I think he just had his second retirement. But it was still Jordan was the standard, right? So if you're going to be the next in basketball, you're going to be the next Jordan. And I wanted in on the hype. I remember watching on ESPN when his high school games were shown on ESPN, and I'm someone that doesn't like to see young people, teenagers, and even preteens shown on national TV. I'm really opposed to the televisation of the Little League World Series. I don't think we should see those little kids on national television.
Especially if they're crying, you know?
But with LeBron, I wanted to see what the hype was about. Yeah, I don't want to see that. Well, the thing was, LeBron was unlikely to cry. And he came and played in Pauley Pavilion. It was an event LeBron played. Sebastian Telfair was in there. It was a high school exhibition. Remember, they played all over the country. And I was a little more uncomfortable with that, the fact that they were taking these kids and traveling them all around the country. I was a little more uncomfortable with that than the fact that they were actually showing their games on television. Why was LeBron from Akron, Ohio, playing a game in Pauley Pavilion in Los Angeles?
So Grant talked about a number of things in that story about LeBron at St. Vincent, St. Mary. By the way, I wonder a high school that is lucky enough to have LeBron, why they need two Saints in their nickname. But anyway, it becomes clear to Grant that wherever LeBron goes, his boys, the LeBronaires, if you want to call them, they're going to go. And where they went was to a Cavalier basketball game where, of course, the soon-to-be king meets the reigning king, who was then in his final season. And Grant picks up that story.
So literally the first day that I arrived in Akron and went to his team's practice and talked to him briefly after that practice, it was clear that he and his buddies, including Maverick Carter, were going to go up an hour from Akron to Cleveland that night for the NBA game between the Cavaliers and Michael Jordan's Washington Wizards. And I'm looking for good access. And so as part of my pitch to LeBron, I was like, can I go? Can I drive you guys in my crappy rental car up to Cleveland and just be a fly on the wall? And thankfully, they said yes. So we end up going to Akron, stuffed about LeBron and Maverick and a couple other friends in my rental car. And we watch this game. LeBron is rooting for Jordan, big Jordan guy, not rooting for the Cavs. And Jordan hits a buzzer beater to win, which is pretty great. And so I remember after the game, LeBron and Maverick said, we're talking about this guy they kept calling Uncle Wes. I'm like, who's Uncle Wes? And turns out it's William Wesley, Worldwide Wes. My first ever experience with the guy, this amazingly well-dressed, bald guy who brings Michael out. And it was clear also that Jordan was in recruiting mode because he was trying to get LeBron to sign for Nike. Got to build a relationship with LeBron and Maverick, ended up going to LeBron's apartment in West Akron, where there was a on the TV, there was a fake Sports Illustrated somebody had made for him with LeBron on the cover. It was like, is he the next Michael Jordan? You know, that ends up in the story. I remember LeBron communicating with Sebastian Telfair on his two-way pager in the car on the drive. And I remember LeBron bringing this big notebook full of CDs out. So he was like the DJ. And it was just a lot of good stuff.
Nothing much has to be explained in that, J.A., except you're the one better than me to explain Worldwide Wes to everyone.
But I'm not sure Worldwide Wes is explicable. I can't tell you how, where, or when I got to know him. I just did. And that fits his profile because he kind of just is. He's there. And by there, I mean everywhere. Wherever you go, it seems like Worldwide Wes would show up. So NBA playoffs, you're in Miami or you're in Chicago, and there's Wes, of course, with full access, everything that you get with the media credential Wes has. And Wes is somebody that I think he first got into the basketball world through Milt Wagner and Louisville.
I think, yeah, Rip Hamilton. He was a Rip Hamilton connection, too.
No, but well, but it goes way earlier than that. And also, he was hanging out in Miami with, like, the Michael Irvin and the U back in the days, the Miami football team. And so through that, he got to hang out with the Dallas Cowboys. Like, you'll see him on the sidelines or in the stands or courtside throughout all these periods at the infamous Malice in the Palace. He's there helping get guys off the court. There's like Wes is everywhere. He's a confidant. He's an advisor. You know, you heard LeBron call him Uncle Wes. He's a connector, I'd say a facilitator. Those are some of his greatest assets, is that he's so plugged into everyone. And so he can help you get from this place to that place, help this person meet that person. And he's just someone who's everywhere and yet nowhere, because you can't pin him down. He's really, I think, something that could kind of only exist in the NBA. He's one of my favorite NBA figures, even if he's one of the least understood NBA figures.
He's like so many people, he manages to be famous for being famous, you know, which is a pretty good art. Anyway, so this was all during his junior year. LeBron turns to his senior year, just keeps getting better and better. And here's one of his future Redeem Team teammates, Darren Williams, who himself was a high school star back when LeBron had Akron rolling for something other than Goodyear tires.
Of course, I had already, you know, heard all the hype and, you know, had read about him and you know, seen highlights on the internet, but I had never played against him. And then I saw him, I think the first time I saw him was in LA. He was playing for like the Oakland Soldiers, and it was like him and Leon Poe on the same team, and they were just dominant, and I was definitely impressed. And then I went to ABCD camp that summer and saw him again there, and saw him and Carmelo go against each other, Lenny Cook, all the guys that, you know, they were talking about as being the next ones. And so that's kind of my first experience with him.
Well, when you're a good player also, do you look at it the same way we do, like, oh, that is the next one? Or do you go, he's not that good? Or do you see something with LeBron, like, right away?
No, I think I saw something with him. You know, you could tell that he was going to be special. Of course, nobody knew this. I mean, who could have predicted, you know, he was going to be this, you know, especially at 36. I don't think anybody could have predicted this type of future.
Interestingly, Darren mentioned two other players in there, Leon Powell and Lenny Cook, who were in some quarters considered as good as LeBron. They turned out more to be cautionary tales. You're listening to Kobe, LeBron, and the Redeem Team. We'll be back in a minute. So by the time LeBron is a senior, even, you know, I've come around and say, this guy is marvelous. This guy is number one. This guy, I thought, projected as clear a number one pick as anyone since Magic in 1979. Remember, Bird had already been selected territorially back in 1978. And maybe Shaq in 92, ahead of Leitner. But Adande tells me that that's not really the case.
There was some debate, and I remember speaking to at least one and probably even two NBA executives who would have taken Carmelo Anthony if they had the number one pick. And the thought behind that was we'd seen Carmelo succeed at the highest level available to him, which was the NCAA tournament. Remember, 1 year at Syracuse. He leads Syracuse and Jim Boeheim to his first national championship. Despite all the great teams Boeheim had, he'd never had a national champion until Carmelo comes along. And we'll hear the pride that Boeheim takes in Carmelo throughout this podcast series. They're forever bonded. But Carmelo was somewhat of a made man because of that. And there was some thought that, well, LeBron, as great as he is, he's playing against high school guys. We don't necessarily know what he can do. If you ask him to step up another level, we've seen Carmelo succeed at the highest level available to him. So there was some thought.
I'm trying to think of examples. I'm sure there were Lou Alcindor at UCLA, but that guy dragged Syracuse to the NCAA championship, man. I mean, he was a serious guy during there. But nevertheless, comes a moment in New York when the late, great David Stern announces.
With the first pick in the 2003 NBA draft, the Cleveland Cavaliers select LeBron James.
By that time, LeBron and Carmelo, they've played against each other in high school. They recognize that they are, you know, the next two big things in whatever order that might be. And they're both in New York, ready to go 1-2 in the draft and create a new storyline and a kind of Rust Belt rivalry between Cleveland and Detroit. And here's Carmelo talking about it.
There's a picture of, like, me and LeBron. I'm leaning over my table at the chair, and, like, LeBron, we facing, like, each other. But that conversation was, yo, you about to go to Cleveland. And he's like, man, you about to go to Detroit. Like, you about to be right there next to us. Like, we're going to be right next door to each other. This is the new game. You know, we the new Magic Bird. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, that's how we were thinking at that point in time. Because we had the hype coming out of, you know, me coming out of college, him, you know, being the number one high school player, being drafted. So we had that hype around us. And then as he gets called, I get the call. My agent is there just like, man, he's like, Detroit is up next. He's like, Detroit taking Darko. I'm like, what?
Yes, ladies and gentlemen. Darko Milicic went second to Detroit before Carmelo Anthony, who was third, before Chris Bosh, who was fourth, and before Dwayne Wade, who was fifth. So that is fully, as we said before, that is one-third of the kids who 5 years later would be on the Redeem Team. But that draft, interestingly, J.A., that gave us those guys, I think that's probably ranked among the greatest drafts of all time. Do you have any memories of other great drafts?
It's right up there. I mean, to me, I think the standard has to be the 1984 draft. If nothing else, it gave us Michael Jordan, but also Hakeem Olajuwon, Charles Barkley, John Stockton's in there as well. So if you think about stocking Olympic teams, you've got Barkley, Jordan, and John Stockton. So there's a third of the 92 Dream Team comes out of that one draft, similar to the way that 2003 draft stocked the Redeem Team in 2008.
Yeah, another great draft was your guy, though, was Kobe. Kobe in 96. You got Kobe, you got Ray Allen, you got Steve Nash, you got
Iverson at the top of that.
AI was right there. Peja Stojakovic, Marcus Camby, Stephon Marbury, a bunch of guys. Derek Fisher, you know, who played out and you watched for 100 years when he was...
Won 5 championships with Kobe. Yeah.
Making jump shots out in L.A. But it was a great draft. You know, what's funny, by the way, to me, is why... Maybe there was, but I don't remember. Maybe because nobody gives too much of a damn about Cleveland, but was there ever an examination of how LeBron got to Cleveland? He had a 22... You remember Ewing and the New York conspiracy. Good old LeBron only had about a 22% chance of going to Cleveland, but nevertheless, there he was. And I don't think there has ever been one athlete, correct me if I'm wrong, who has ever brought more of a renaissance to one city. I mean, Chicago, you know, Michael went to Chicago. Chicago was already a pretty damn great city, you know. Elgin, Jerry West, Kareem, Magic, Kobe later. L.A. was a pretty good city, too. They had other stuff going on. LeBron to Cleveland, that set things off, man.
That was everything. Well, there was that great YouTube video, the Cleveland Tourism Board or something like that. It was like a mock Cleveland promotional video, which really pointed out all the things that were wrong with Cleveland. But one of the lines in there is, our economy is built on LeBron James. And it was true. I mean, Jack, what reason did you have to go to Cleveland before? Now, they had a pretty good team in the 90s that Michael Jordan ended with a couple of well-placed and well-timed shots. So they were on the rise in the 90s, but or the early 90s. But then the football team leaves to go to Baltimore, right? And so then they're blessed with another team soon thereafter. But they have to start from scratch all over again with an expansion football team. The Indians went to the World Series, were a game away in 97, I believe it was, from winning the World Series. But most of the history of that franchise is one of futility. But with LeBron, Cleveland was quickly became at the center of the NBA.
I was assigned, of course, to write. I was on the beat then. And the big preseason story was going to be LeBron. And I'm going to tell you about my interview session with him. But this is what I wrote. One of the paragraphs I wrote in the LeBron story. The Cleveland law firm that represents James has pursued more than 1,000 infringements on LeBron's name and image. This was before he played a game, by the way. Already, he is an economic system as much as he is an athlete, the primary link in a long chain of dependency. His performance on the court and his comportment off it bear consequence for, take a deep breath, a city, a franchise, a coach, a general manager, a league, several corporations, and extended family bound to get even more extended. But I remember, you know, vividly sitting down for LeBron for this interview, and he comes in, his physical presence, you know, filling the room. But he's still a young-looking kid. It's interesting, you know, as we get older, when you see shots of these kids when they were young. My God, you ever wonder, God, was I ever that young? Anyway, LeBron's the first guy I ever sat down with who I thought, this was 18 years ago, I remember thinking for the first time, I'm not only old enough to be his father, I'm old enough to be his grandfather. So I'm here with Sports Illustrated, the great photographer, Walter Yost, who in a line of immortal SI photographers may be at the top. And Walter takes about 3 hours just to set up his lighting. And LeBron comes in. I can't remember who he came in with, the public relations people. There was probably a cadre of them. And they announced, okay, you have 15 minutes for the interview, and you have 10 minutes for the picture. And, you know, Walter just about like falls dead over, man. This is not how we did things at Hallowed Sports Illustrated. But LeBron... You know, was fine during the interview, but you know, it was the first time I realized he didn't really give a shit about Sports Illustrated, right? Different generation.
Yeah, and this was a different era. I mean, he comes in with a $90 million contract with Nike. He's got the full package, right? He's as complete a player that's entered the league in a long time, if possibly ever. But he's also prepackaged. And I think people had to learn the rules that, yeah, this was even different from Kobe. Kobe, you could kind of, his rookie year, he's out there, you could approach him before the game, sit down next to him as he's out on the court warming up and talk with him. Jack, is it fair to say LeBron wasn't quite as approachable even as a rookie, even as a high school kid coming in?
No, absolutely. And he was a little, just because of that physical presence, he was intimidating. But you do have to be careful about generalizations and stereotypes, because LeBron wasn't one of these kids who didn't understand history. I mean, he understood, you know, he wasn't like, his mind wasn't a blank slate about basketball. He understood basketball history. And that's one of the things we're later going to hear when he got around people like Krzyzewski and Jerry Colangelo. They understood what this guy knew. He just, as part of his culture, you know, Sports Illustrated just, it wasn't it. And Kobe, it might not have been it either, but Kobe was always smart enough and kind of canny enough that he had to play with Slam, but he also had to play with Sports Illustrated and ESPN.
And the LA Times. And Kobe, I think, was the last line that understood he needed to maintain a relationship with the local newspaper columnists. And he needed to always have at least one on his side. And that was a Kobe thing. And I think, again, that difference, it's really a generation in the NBA from the 96 draft to the 2003 draft. That's a full NBA generation. And LeBron's generation, like LeBron didn't really have guys, it felt like, in the Cleveland local media. I think he came in thinking, okay, I'm dealing with national only. Whereas Kobe still had people that he talked to locally, and that was a big difference.
Yeah. I can't say I broke much news during that interview. I don't know whether I was the first one to mention his affinity for Fruity Pebbles, which is how he began each morning, and later had a Fruity Pebbles line of Nikes. I'm not sure that you purchased one of those, but the story, there was so much to write about. I remember it carried a great headline. It said, "You got to carry that weight," which is a great Beatles song. But it was just the stuff on LeBron's shoulders when he went into the league. And look, we're going to talk more about this as we go on. But man, LeBron, if there's anybody that could have taken a bunch of fatal bad steps, concluding some of the tough things about his background, the pressures that were on him on and off the court, the people that wanted in on LeBron world, I would argue the guy has done it better than anyone who ever lived. And I always say that to the LeBron critics. I don't know how you could have been any better than this kid.
Yeah, Jack. Despite all that attention, despite all that scrutiny, I think the worst trouble he's been in with the law was a moving violation with his Hummer. That was another story. How he had his Humvee, his Hummer in high school, but he got a moving violation in it. And that was the extent of his run-ins with the law, right? I mean, the biggest criticism of him was he went on television to announce his free agency decision. And that set people off. And, you know, how could he do this? And it was betrayal and all this. He went on television to announce his free agency decision. And that was the biggest criticism. That was his greatest mistake he ever made. And if that's his biggest mistake, I think he's lived a pretty good and a pretty clean life.
You know that phrase too, taking my talents? I can't remember now, but I had heard that.
Kobe said it.
That's who said it.
Kobe said it when he announced he was going from high school to the NBA. He said, "I'm taking my talents to the NBA."
I didn't know that until I looked that back up. So somewhere in LeBron's brain, I bet you that phrase from Kobe was cemented somehow, you know, taking my talents. But LeBron has a great rookie season. Interestingly, he's a runaway winner for the Rookie of the Year, and tying this back into the 2008 Redeem Team, number two is Carmelo in the voting. Number three is Dwayne Wade. Number four is Kirk Heinrich, who was a guard with, I think, Chicago, who had a pretty good player. And Chris Bosh was fifth. So four-fifths of that draft class is in the top five of the rookie voting. But what I had forgotten is how good Carmelo was during that season. And it sort of touched off maybe what could be a trend of LeBron overshadowing Carmelo. Carmelo took a 17-win team to a 43-win team and the playoffs, where he got, they did lose in the first round to the other great high schooler going on then, KG in the Minnesota Timberwolves.
Jack, quick thing on LeBron's rookie season. He averaged 20 points per game that year. Not bad, right? Only time in his career he averaged less than 25 points. And then he starts this record-setting run of averaging 25 points per game or more. Surpasses everyone. Wilt, Kareem, everyone. So a really amazing breakthrough. And to think that that was, it's really by far his worst season. And he still comes in the league averaging 20 points per game.
And part of that was that personality we talked to, that LeBron probably paid more, how was I going to put it, more attention to the idea that the rookie shouldn't complete. His quotes are filled with, oh, this is Ricky Davison and Z's team. You know, it's not mine.
And remember, his coach is Paul Silas, right? An old school, hardline guy who's not going to let some rookie come in and just get LeBron got all the attention, but he wasn't going to get all the shots and have the ball all the time, not under Paul Silas.
Well, I had a great interview with Paul Silas, and I remember he was talking about LeBron's many talents, and Silas said to me, well, I had one talent. You got to have one NBA talent. Mine? Whooping ass. That was my, that's what Paul Silas said. So one of the things is Carmelo came in after 1 year, but you know, with the ease with which LeBron, players like LeBron, Kobe, and Garnett did this, Carmelo Anthony had 1 year of college, and Carmelo reflects a little bit on this kind of, that, hey, this isn't the easiest thing in the world to do.
When you come out of high school, you got to learn on the fly. Like, you got to get it right away. And that is the difference between the guys that are very successful coming out of high school and the guys that it take a long time to figure it out. It's a small group of guys that come out of high school and they have it right away. You know, the LeBrons, the KGs, the Kobes, like those guys come out of high school, they had it right away. They got it. And then you have a long list of guys who come out of high school that don't. It take a while for them to figure it out.
They didn't have to be the man when they came in, and neither one of them started right away. You know, Kobe comes on a team with Shaq. You know, KG had a lot of veterans. LeBron came in, and he had to be the man and the face of a franchise and even the face of a league to some extent right away. And, you know, as someone who knew him going in and as someone who's good friends with him, I just wonder what your perspective or your appreciation is for somebody to come out of high school and take on all of that responsibility right away.
You have to be committed. It's a different type of commitment that you have to have, a different type of dedication. You have to have the right people around you. You know, LeBron is a blueprint for that. You know, he came out, he had the right team around him. I mean, as far as not basketball, but just the right people around him, that the blueprint was already laid out. All he had to do was stay on that track and follow that blueprint, and it was there for him. Whereas other guys, it's not laid out for guys like that. You know, and I think, you know, it's a testament to LeBron and his people, because they saw previous people coming out of high school and what that did. You know, I'm sure they saw what it did with Kobe and what it did, you know, with KG and just other guys that came out of high school. It takes a lot. It takes a lot in a different type of person to come out of high school, jump right into the big leagues and be and have an impact the way that LeBron has done. Like you said, Kobe came in, he, you know, came off the bench and he had to really force his way and prove to everybody and have this certain type of chip on his shoulder that he was here to stay.
So not only is there rookie pressure, but this is an Olympic year. And the Olympic team, the Olympic program is in flux as Sean Ford, a respected USA basketball exec, who's now the national team director, as he tells us.
Over that time, injury and, you know, the situation of the world, guys weren't able to play. Jason was hurt. Ray was hurt. Jermaine was hurt. You know, it just wasn't working, you know, out the way we wanted it to. And, you know, we went a little bit younger.
So there's a lot of things going on. There's injuries. There's worries about terrorism. So they can't fill a team. They can't get exactly the guys they want for various reasons. Kevin Garnett's not going to play. Tracy McGrady's not going to play. So who do they call on? They call on the kids. And even for kids as talented as LeBron, Carmelo, and Dwayne Wade, this is a tall order in a world that has gotten increasingly better since the Dream Team devoured everyone back in 1992. This is Dwayne Wade.
We really had not a clue what we was getting into. We were just happy to be named to Olympic team and be playing.
And this is how Carmelo saw it.
I think things could have been different. But we never had time. I mean, we came at the last minute. Me and LeBron and D-Wade, we got the calls at the last minute. And the way that we looked at it was like, shit, we on here for the roster fillers. You know, we're a part of, we're going to come on the roster fillers. You know, if they really calling us, that means they really want us to play.
The world was different. The world did not look at United States basketball teams the same way they did in 92. And I suppose in 96. And reflecting on that is Craig Miller, who headed up USA Basketball's public relations, still does, but he was there since before the Dream Team. Here's how he put it.
The stigma of playing against NBA players had faded because the international players are now ingrained in the NBA and playing. And so you started to see the gap really close.
So that gap really closed. It slammed shut. The most stupefying game happened, of course, right away. The initial mind-boggling 92-73 loss to Puerto Rico. I'll never forget, Jay, Tommy Shepard, who's now the general manager of the Washington Wizards, so he has to watch his tongue a little more. But Tommy was just, he was working for USA Basketball over there. Always a funny guy, I'm sure you know Tommy. Tommy goes by me after the 19-point list. He goes, well, we were in it till the tip. You know, it was just this indescribable loss that was led by this point guard. Hey, nice NBA player. Carlos Arroyo was in the league for, probably was in the league for 10 years, played for 7 or 8 teams, and he just destroyed the United States. And it was kind of a lesson. Isaiah Thomas told me a long time ago, Jay, it sounds elementary, but there's certain things I remember. And he goes, Isaiah said, if you have a point guard who gets where he wants to go, he can give a team trouble. You know, there were guys like that, like Bobby Hurley, Steve Nash. You didn't know how they got there, but they got themselves in the position where they could either shoot it or feed to somebody. And this is what Arroyo did.
Yeah. And it's funny because the point guard on the United States team was Allen Iverson, who wasn't that classic point guard player, right? So Allen Iverson could be an unstoppable force, but that doesn't necessarily work in international basketball. And that team really struggled more than most to adapting to international rules, which include the ability you can knock the ball off the rim right after it hits the rim. It's got the wider, it had the wider trapezoid lanes, so you couldn't post up as close to the basket. And Tim Duncan really seemed to struggle under those rules and just never acquired a taste for it. Also, the thing I remember with that team is that they didn't get the calls that they were used to getting from NBA referees. You've got international refs, and they called the game differently, and you didn't get those superstar calls. So it felt like that team was constantly in foul trouble throughout the Olympics and was griping about the officiating.
Yeah, and there was a lot of things going on. The essence of it goes back to them being a team that was formed kind of in haste, and we're going to talk about how the program changes specifically because of this Olympics. But Ginobili, one of the great Argentine player who they won the gold medal, I remember Manu talking during the Olympics, and he said, I wish I could do a Ginobili accent. I'm not going to try. The rest of the world is getting better. The U.S. is getting bored. But I'm not sure that's what it was. I just think it was a mismatched team. And I wrote a story for SI after the first game, the loss to Puerto Rico. And one of the funny things, I'll never forget this, LeBron, I don't know why he said it, but here's my paragraph. The one bright spot was LeBron James's scholastic acuity. Quote, some Americans might say this is embarrassing, losing to Puerto Rico, a commonwealth of the United States. LeBron, I would have said, wow. I would have guessed territory, man, but I looked it up. You know, it's still a commonwealth. Anyway, what I detected through this Olympics, throughout it, and I remember I did an interview with Brian Williams, who was then becoming the new NBC star, and he was kind of positioning himself as...
Not the basketball player Brian Williams, the news anchor Brian Williams.
No, not that guy, yeah. the kind of the NASCAR loving liberal. That was kind of, and I did this interview with him, and the level of hatred that was leveled against this team, not just because they were losing, but I really detected a really kind of racist attitude toward it. A lot of it directed toward Iverson, who did not deserve it, not for the way he played and comported himself during this Olympics.
Yeah, so as Ginobili suggested, maybe Americans and even the players are becoming a little bit disinterested. And I would say the fan base was becoming even more than disinterested, disconnected. And it started in 96 and certainly through 2000. Also notable development in 2000, that's the first time the United States Olympic basketball team is all African-Americans on the roster. And it had been declining in 96. You had John Stockton was the only white player on the American team. By 2000, and with this 2004 roster, it's all black. So you have to wonder if that accelerates the disconnect among white Americans. But there was this feeling almost like people were rooting against them. Like they wanted to see the American team lose, almost as if, well, they don't represent me and quote unquote us. And I almost want to see them lose. That you had that sense, like people wanted to see them get their comeuppance. And yes, part of that was Iverson, who was a very controversial figure, a very threatening figure to some people. It's interesting because younger people of all races adored Iverson. And he represented that rebellious figure that I think any teenager looks up to and wants to emulate in some regard. But for old Americans, and that included even older black basketball players, he represented such a threat to the status quo that I think they wanted to see him fail. Because for him to succeed would be to turn around and upend everything that they'd become accustomed to and that basically that they had built up.
Right. And Iverson's go-to comments throughout these Olympics, he must have said this 7 or 8 times. When you talk to some guys, they were pissed off. They, behind their back and in public, they trashed Larry Brown, who, by the way, let's face it, was entirely the wrong coach to be coaching this team. That was problem number 2, right behind the disorganized nature of the organization of the team. Larry being the wrong coach was number 2. Allen would say, here's the quote, just understand, I'm not going to attempt to do Iverson, just understand that first and foremost, it's an honor to be selected to this team. I feel like a special basketball player to be selected to a team like this. And I stand behind no man in my respect for Tim Duncan as a player. I think he, as an offensive and defensive player combined, he could be a top 10 player of all time. But man, he was terrible during this Olympics, and he could not figure out how to seize the reins of the team. You know, he could always figure that out. And him and Pop were both on this team. And whether or not they couldn't get by Larry, or whether they were too disgruntled from the beginning, or whether they read the handwriting on the wall, we're just not as good as Argentina at this point. All those things, you know, Tim just did not do what he should have. And before we comment some more on that, here's Sean Ford, again, the respected basketball official, just reflecting a little bit on Iverson.
He took the hit, you know, with the media a lot when we did lose. Allen's got a toughness about him. And because there's so much goes on around his life, he has a way of, when it comes to basketball, he was able to focus and leave some things, you know, elsewhere. And I think because he does that on a regular basis, the players learn, you know, he brought the other players that way. And the people that were doubting them and the people who were criticizing them, you know, and again, there wasn't social media back then. There wasn't as much, but he kept the team focused on, you know, what was next.
And so, Jack, I'll say that in some ways, though, the 2004 Olympics were Iverson's finest moment, because from everything that I've heard, I wasn't there, but from everything I've heard, he really rallied them after their shot at the gold medal was gone. And they had this, you know, essentially the consolation game, right? Like the old NCAA Final Four consolation game to win the bronze medal. And none of them came there to win the bronze medal. That's not what they're interested in. But Iverson said, hey, we're here. Let's do it. Let's not go home empty handed. Let's go out and win this game and win this bronze medal. and he inspired them and had an inspired performance, and they won. And to some observers, they've told me that that was Iverson's finest moment, that he salvaged what there was to be salvaged out of that Olympic Games.
Absolutely. I mean, I covered those Olympics, and I remember talking to Doug Collins before the bronze medal game, and we both just kind of said, I, you know, there's just no way they win this. First of all, Lithuania was very good. They were the early kind of Golden State Warriors. I mean, they just bombed up three-point shots. And for Iverson was really good in that game. Sean Marion was good in that game. And I'll tell you one somebody else who was really good. I almost hesitate to say his name because we could do a 40-minute podcast on him, and that was Lamar Odom. That when Lamar had your back, when he was like the fourth guy or something, that you needed him not to score, but maybe to get 9, 10, 11, get your rebounds, lock somebody down, sometimes even the, you know, the shooting guard, he could go out and defend on pick and rolls, he could go back and get rebounds. Lamar was really great in that game, and I agree that if they wanted to get one positive note out of those Olympics, it would have been that third place game against Lithuania. However, they didn't, Jay, and the result of that was big changes to the Olympic system.
Yes, sometimes, Jack, it takes something this drastic to wake you up and to shake you up, and that's what happened. And as we'll get into in the next episode, big changes were coming.
And the biggest, probably the biggest first change, was when they went to the ultimate man behind the man, the great Jerry Colangelo, who for some reason had not been called upon to offer his executive know-it-all to previous Olympic teams. And David Stern, who sometimes got involved in the Olympic movement and sometimes did not, but in this case, David was going to call the man behind the man, and he placed a call to Jerry Colangelo and asked him if he wanted to take over. And this is a hint of what we're going to get in the next episode, which is episode 4.
He says, Jerry, look, I know you were just as unhappy as me and everyone else regarding the showing in Greece and all the things about it, and there needs to be some change. Would you be willing to take on the responsibility for USA basketball? And I'm instinctive, and I basically said, yeah, I'll do it, but I have a couple of conditions.
So that's it for this episode. I'm Jack McCallum. Thanks for listening.
I'm Jay Adande. Check us out next time on Kobe, LeBron, and the Redeem Team.
The Dream Team Tapes Season 2, Kobe, LeBron, and the Redeem Team, is a production of Diversion Podcasts in association with iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. This season is written and hosted by me, Jack McCallum, and J.A. Adande. Executive producers Scott Waxman and Mark Francis for Diversion Podcast and Sean Titone for iHeartRadio. Our editorial director is John Tuttle. Supervising producer Brian Murphy. Legal producer Freddie Overstegen. Editing, mixing, and sound design by Mark Francis. Verna Fields is our technical producer, and our director of marketing and business development is Jacob Bronstein.
Diversion Podcasts.